Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings. I'm joined today by James Johnson, our Chief of Chaplains, and also by Brett Durbin, who is part of our chaplaincy team and is also involved with our church partners. And so I'm glad to have both of you guys with us today. The topic we're going to be talking about is near and dear to my heart because I am personally sick of this world of sin and pain and suffering and death. And I really want to go home and have heaven and Jesus. And so our topic today is, as Christians, do we still believe the second coming is imminent? Do we believe in the second coming, and do we believe it's imminent? It's coming soon. That's the topic.
I think this gets it's really muddy because we often confuse and conflate Bible predictions and prophecies. And you know, in the ministry of Jesus, especially toward the end, Jesus talks about, you know, three different, which we could fall into the category of three different types of comings. And I don't like to use that word because it gets confusing. Normally when we talk about the second coming, we're talking about the return of Jesus back to this world to set all things right, to bring judgment, to bring restoration, to bring healing, the new heaven and the new earth, set everything right again. But there are two other ones that we often confuse and conflate, and I think that's what causes a lot of the muddiness of it. The first is the coming of the kingdom. Jesus, once he started his earthly ministry after his temptation in the desert, said people need to repent. Why? Because the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, is now near. It's come close to you. It's here again. And Jesus actually tells the religious leaders in Luke 17, they say, hey, when are we going to see this kingdom come? What are going to be the signs of it being here? And Jesus says you won't be able to see it with physical signs because the kingdom of God is now already in your midst.
Well, he says it's also within you.
Right. And that's the one of the debated translations for that, because was the actual kingdom inside of the Pharisees? Or is it more in your midst? And I think it is inside of us in the way we live. I don't think that's wrong in that aspect. But I do think that Jesus was telling them, it's already here. The kingdom is in your midst. Mm-hmm. So the kingdom had come, but there's another coming, right? Because Jesus taught us to pray, Lord, let your kingdom come, your will be done here on earth as it is in heaven. Well, how's God's kingdom operated in heaven? Everybody is in submission to him and his way of doing things. And the earth isn't there yet, but Jesus said the kingdom is already here. It was in their midst. So that's the first coming that's already happened. The second coming that we end up, and I hate to say it that way, the second event of coming is a coming judgment on Israel. That Jesus tells the disciples in what we call the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25 and Luke chapter 21, specific things they would see happen. Jesus said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, flee to the hills. That he says, when you see these events take place, that coming is at hand. And Jesus uses language that we often miss because we're not familiar with apocalyptic language. Apocalyptic language was very common at the time of Jesus coming out of the intertestamental period of the exile back to the return. And apocalyptic literature was a very, very popular genre. And it uses phrases that are fantastic in their imagery to symbolize an earthly reality. And one of those is the idea of coming on the clouds. Jesus says that to the disciples, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds and in great glory. And we know that's a kickback, a reference to the one like a Son of Man that comes in the book of Daniel in front of the Ancient of Days and receives all power, all glory, and authority in heaven and earth. Jesus connects himself to that figure. And he even tells the high priest, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. So he's telling them they will see these things. Jesus tells them in the Olivet Discourse, this generation won't pass away until you see these things happen. And they did. We saw that coming judgment of Israel for their refusal to get in sync with God, to follow the Mosaic covenant that they promised they would, and they didn't. And then Jesus said judgment will come on Israel, and we saw that happen. But when we talk about the second coming, we're talking about the return of Jesus to set all things right. And that hasn't happened yet. But two of those three things have. And when we conflate those comings, the day of the Lord event that Jesus talks about, that will happen to Israel, the coming of the kingdom that's already here, we can often confuse those comings that the Bible talks about to a future event. And then we say, oh, well, God, you're a liar because you said it was going to happen soon. And it's been 2,000 years. You know, the writers of the New Testament were expecting an imminent coming of Jesus to do what he said. But which coming are we talking about? The coming of the kingdom, the coming in judgment on Israel, or the actual coming, what we call the second coming, to actually set all things right? We haven't seen that happen yet. So that's the imminence I think we're still looking towards.
Okay. So thanks for trying to disentangle those three differences. So to our question that we're going to focus on, having disentangled, and let's stick with this portion.
Yes.
Do we believe as a body of believers in Jesus Christ that he is coming back to eliminate sin from his universe, to make the earth new, the new heaven and the earth that Revelation talks about? Do we still believe that that's going to happen as Christians? Does Christian communities still believe that? And do we believe we're living in a generation that could actually see that happen?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I guess, and where I would stand on that is probably as every generation in the church since he left. Yeah, it could be ours. You know, I think that's
so.
That's,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, but yes, absolutely. That's what we're waiting on. That is what's coming. And I'm with you. It'd be great if it happened today. You know, but is it going to happen? Is it imminent in a true, like, are we seeing something to tell us that versus what maybe every generation has felt since he left? That's hard to answer.
That's what I want to hone in on because it's true that every generation has been looking forward. In the Thessalonian church, Paul is writing them because they actually were starting to get discouraged because they had members dying. And he's encouraging them, okay? Don't be discouraged. And he tells them about the, you know, don't want you to grieve like those who have no hope, and talks about how that second coming is going to happen. And the dead in Christ are going to rise first, and the trumpet call of God and the voice of the archangel. So there's going to be a tremendous event that he's encouraging them because they were already expecting it by this time. And so that first generation church was looking for it, and every generation since has been looking for it. So while that's true, does that mean we should be discouraged and you know, when Jesus said, nobody knows the day or the hour, so therefore you just can't really know. While we say, this is the point of my this program, while we say we believe in the coming of Christ, do we actually function like we don't believe in the coming? Because it'll just happen sometime. Our generation doesn't really need to worry about it because we have enough history to know that things will just kind of continue on like they've been. And one day in the future, grandkids, great-grandkids down the road, he'll come. We do believe that, but we don't need to actually prepare.
Yeah, and this is what Jesus warned the disciples about, you know, using the metaphor of a wedding, right? That the Middle Eastern weddings and the first few phases were all about the contract and the dowry payment and all of that, and the bride would come and live with the groom. But when it was time for the wedding, the bride would leave the groom's family home that she had been living in. That's why when Jesus said, in my father's house, there are many rooms, that the bride would leave her family and go into the groom's father's house and live there while the groom prepared a place for them to live as a family. And Jesus said, I'm going to go prepare a place for you. But he gives them, in a different passage, he gives them the warning to say, hey, don't be like the bridesmaids who didn't keep enough oil for their lamps, to stay ready, to stay prepared, because you don't know when the groom is going.
Because the bridegroom delayed?
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't that in the parable there was a delay?
And it's that expectation that we've seen all of those first things happen. We've seen all through, you know, the metaphor of the wedding where, you know, hey, is there an agreement? Yeah, God made an agreement with people, the covenants. You know, is there a price paid? Yes, Jesus paid the price for us. Is there a place where we're in the Father's house with, that's where, you know, where we are in this place. When we die, we go to be with God in the many rooms that he's made for us. And now we're waiting. But yeah, we have to be prepared because of that delay.
So the delay, of course, Peter gives us a clue as to why.
Mm-hmm.
With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years. He's not slow in keeping his promises, right, but he waits for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wants to be patient so everybody can come into the kingdom that wants it. Mm-hmm.
Because there are still people who are savable, mm-hmm, who haven't actually made that decision to give their hearts to the Lord.
That's right.
And so the delay, when you understand it in this light, does not undermine our confidence in our God. It magnifies because we see the quality of the being he is, a patient, gracious being who loves. If, as a father with several children, if one of your children was not ready for departure or whatever, Are you taking off from the rest stop without them? Okay. Or are you delaying the departure to wait for the one who, you see what I'm saying? Yeah. And so God's delay shows us that we, yes, because he is worthy of our love. He's worthy of our trust. He sacrificed himself in Christ for our salvation. Yes, he wants everyone to come to salvation. So he keeps waiting and waiting. So I see the delay as an encouragement, mm-hmm. but at the same time, Peter also said that we can hasten the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do we understand that to mean? Hasten. So the delay on the one hand, and this is really quick because I've heard Christians think, well, it doesn't matter because God knows. God knows the day and the hour. He knows when he's coming back. And because he knows, it's kind of like set. And because it's set, it doesn't matter what we do. Have you heard this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that contradicts the idea of him delaying because people are not yet ready, and also Peter's instruction of hastening.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it we hasten? We can hasten, but he already knows when he's coming. How do you put those together?
Well, I mean, when I think of maybe this helps answer that, but if we look at it's imminent, and Jesus seemed to make that clear, because I can just picture all of the first century guys literally every week price, and you think it's this week. So you think it's this week. We don't really do that now, so that has died down. But I think the message is the same, is that if it's imminent, that means that each day is critical. And what you do with each of those days is critical. It's kind of like someone who goes to a funeral. How many times do you see people there all of a sudden just, they're kind of reinvigorated for life because they don't know when it's going to end. You don't know when your last day is. And so
at an individual level, their life could end. Yes, yes. Yeah, yes. For them, yes.
Yeah. So, but the imminence thing is, to me as a believer, I should be looking at that not in what can I get out of my life, but how much can I share his word and his message and who he is with other people.
Would that be hastening the day?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So our activity, when this gospel, the kingdom goes to the whole world as witness. Okay, so our activity in sharing the gospel, would that be an element of how we can hasten the day? And so how do we then, how do we connect the idea that we're hastening it, but God already knows when it is? My simple example, his foreknowledge is knowledge of the future. It's not causation.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had a time machine and we went and watched the next Super Bowl and we came back, and we now know every play. We know who's going to throw the pass, what the final scores are. We know exactly how that's going to turn out. Does our knowledge mean that those players still don't have to get out on the field and do their plays? Okay, they still have to go out and run the plays in order for that outcome to occur. So God's knowledge is not, God knows that because mm-hmm. of what we're going to do as his witnesses and agents.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where, Peter, in a different passage tells us that we are now Christ's ambassadors. Like he says, God is making his appeal through us. And that's the idea that we are the agency that God is using to give that opportunity to people. And if we don't do that, then it's going to keep taking time. But if we can hasten it, like you said, by actually doing what God calls us.
So I want to keep honing down on this. As Christians, mm-hmm. any Christian through history has always believed Jesus is coming again.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be an eventual heaven, new heaven, new earth, and so forth and so on. So we all believe that. My question I want us to hone in on, is there any reason, legitimate, biblical mm-hmm. reason, that we would have to believe that we're in that last generation, that end of what the Bible calls the end of time, mm-hmm. The end times.
Yeah.
There's any reason to believe we're in those times?
I think so.
Okay. And the question is, what would be the evidences that we could point to for our listening audience to say, this is not just the traditional belief through 2000 years, that where we stand in time
mm-hmm.
lets us know we are at the last cusp before Christ returns. Are there any evidences of that?
The biggest one I look at it, and this is more of a, I don't want to call it anecdotal because it's not, being an old missionary guy myself, when you look at how far the gospel has spread now, I'm not saying there are not pockets of unreached people, because there are, there's a lot of them, but the reaching all corners.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
Reaching all corners of the world with the gospel, we are getting closer and closer to that. And even with, weirdly, as talking about technology and things like that is helping us spread it even faster in certain ways. Technology can be really bad and it can be really good in that sense. are we getting close to where his word has been proclaimed to all peoples? That, to me, I would say, will way faster than any time before.
And so one of the evidences then could be, because the Gospels would be that we've seen progressively expanding for, 500 years now, the translation of the Bible and the printing press and then digital distribution. And in other words, the word of God has been expanded, unlike it was, the American Indians, the Incas, they didn't have the word of God brought to them in that way. And so you could look back now with the knowledge that we have that the early church was spreading it, but there's still lots, it hadn't gone to the whole world yet. So one of the evidences is the word of God being translated in a way and going through all these different means and channels is an evidence that, yes, there's a condition that needed to be met in order for the end. And one of them is probably really, if not close to, has been met. In other words, that the availability. Do you think that in most, if somebody wanted to be able to access the Bible today, do you think that most people could if they really wanted to?
So,
even in communist countries, they can get online and get a Bible.
As long as they know it exists,
you know,
I think you'd still have those pockets of people that don't know it exists, but those are shrinking. They're fewer and fewer.
Yeah. So, that would be an element. Other, I like that one. Other reasons to believe we're in those moments in time.
You know, in connection with that, I think not only are we seeing the spread of the gospel itself and the scriptures, but, the scriptures tell us that in those days, knowledge will increase. We are seeing massive advances in technology, massive advances in knowledge. And one of the cool things about it is the more we learn about science, the more we actually are moving towards a recognition of, wow, this isn't just a cosmic accident. There's way too many proofs of intelligent design of what the Bible's saying is true. Dr. Benzio said it this way, that not everything in the Bible has been proven true, but nothing in the Bible has been proven false. And the more we keep learning, the more I think, we've had great conversations about, quantum physics and entanglement, all these things that the Bible has talked about in more spiritual terms. We're seeing scientifically, there's less and less gray for people to decide, okay, yes, God is real, I've been presented with the evidence, and what do I do with that evidence? Do I accept or reject it? And I think that's going to be a very compelling part of it.
So, there are tons of Bible prophecies. Some of them are mysterious, hard to understand. But there is at least one that I think most people agree on, and that was the one in Daniel, the multi-metal man, because the Bible's so clear on what that one means.
Yes.
The head of gold, and it tells you it represents Babylon, followed by another kingdom, which is Medo-Persia, which is the silver, followed by another kingdom, the belly of brass, which is Greece, followed by another kingdom, legs of iron, which was Rome. Okay, and then it's feet which that empire breaks into the 10 toes, which are the clay and the iron. It'll never actually unite and be united again. And then a rock, which comes out with not hands, crushes it, and this is rises up to be the kingdom.
Right.
Okay. So there is and I think most Christians agree that that's describing from the time of Daniel, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then Rome would break up into Europe, into these countries that never actually unite again, and they never did. And then, in that state of a divided Europe, at some point then Christ returns. So at least after the fall of the Roman Empire now, and we could say that is an indicator that we're downstream of that prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and the same thing with the beasts that don't have as many numbers, but right after Rome, that's when that beast, that unnamed beast that we can go right after it being Rome, is when the kingdom comes and it covers the whole earth.
Yeah. So I think there's indicators. Versus the early church. The early church, if we believe that was going to happen, those events hadn't occurred yet, but God foreknew and foresaw these events happening. So that's Paul wrote, Peter wrote in 2 Peter 3:3-4, first of all, you must understand that in the last days, so this is the question, are we in the last days, okay? Last days, scoffers will come.
Mm-hmm.
Scoffing and following their own evil desires, they will say, where is the coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. Are we living in an era where people are saying, these natural evolutionary cycles and so forth, there is no, and he goes on to say, they forget that the world was created out of water and destroyed by water. They forget this. He goes on to say that. Are we living in a time when that's actually become true? There's scoffers. They don't believe in the Bible. They don't believe that the earth was made out of water and destroyed in water. And they scoff. Well, where is this coming then? There is. Do we live in that time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, constantly we have people saying, well, if what you say is true, then, you know, what about this and what about that? And it's a difference between a skeptic who is actually asking questions because they want to learn, like Nicodemus did with Jesus. The scoffer is the person who's the cynic, who's already closed their mind off and hardened their heart and has no desire to truly look at the evidence. There's a whole lot of that.
Right. And so the evolutionary godless model scoffs at the flood, scoffs at special creation, scoffs at a short life on earth history. Okay. Everything continues as it's always been in these evolutionary cycles.
Right.
Okay. I think, you know, if that applies, then you know, at least with the rise of Darwin, the late 18th century, early 19th century, we enter in the last days. And if you look at the landscape of thousands of years, that's the last, few hundred before Christ comes. I'm comfortable with that. Do you think most Christians would be comfortable with that idea too? Or would that make them uncomfortable that we are in the last days and there's evidence with this prophecy?
Some of both. I think that those that are trying to do things God's way would get excited. You know, that just like that's why Jesus used another parable, the idea of the servants, right? The servants who are doing the right thing are ready for the master to come home. They're prepared, they're expecting it, and they're ready to present, whether it's the home where the master returns to and finds the servant who's actually done all the right things and is prepared to greet them, or the parable of the talents where you've got the ones that are doing the right stewardship with the master's resources. But then there's the wicked servants. And I think those would be the Christians who maybe have cognitively given themselves to Jesus, but their hearts haven't been transformed, and they're fearful of that rejection.
So I guess I appreciate that, but my question was, do you think that most Christians would agree that we're in the last days?
I think it would depend on...
If I went into your church and asked, how many think we're in the last days and Jesus is coming soon?
I think in my church here in the United States, in Tallahassee, Florida, most would probably say yes. I think if you were to go to maybe other cultures or different parts of the church around the world, they may not think it's is imminent, you know, and just depending on what they've been taught, you know, what has been the teaching within their church, you know, because I think there has been, I mean, I grew up in the time of Left Behind, right? I mean, those were like, they were the first books I ever really got into. And I wasn't into Christian stuff when I was in high school and in early college. And I was kind of the opposite, but for some reason those pulled me in. And that was this big explosion of that kind of premillennial, pre-tribulation type of teaching. And that was, I mean, they were starting to say, I mean, we've got to be in the last, you know, 10, 20 years. And as time has gone on, I think there's been some question marks around that. And, you know, obviously it was a fictional,
but it occurred right at the turning of the millennium too.
Yes.
And I think that was a huge thing. We were looking forward to
years. And so I think, depending on where you're at, I think your context is going to matter on what you think on that and what you've been taught. What is your church teaching on it? Interpretation of end times?
Do you think that it's valuable for the Christian heart, mission for Christ, personal sanctification, development, use of the being a steward for God and all that? To have that idea be part of their Christian journey, hey, Christ is coming soon. Do you think that is a valuable idea for them to believe in or not?
I think so. And it kind of how I mentioned earlier, almost just like as you look at, if this is my last day, how do I spend it? You know, again, you don't need to look at every single day that way. But I think if you have a mindset and you have a perspective of it is imminent, Jesus is coming, as a believer, I should be wanting to be a better husband, a better father, share the gospel as best I can, be the best friend I can to others, love people the best I can. I think in that sense, I hope all of us see it that way. And for me, even in this conversation, it makes me think of those things, you know, where, you know, I think having more of a focus on, gosh, it really could be today. You know, he may come back today. And dude, just like you said, the servant who was ready for the master to return, I hope I fall into that category, you know, when he does. And so I think in terms of even just a behavioral thing, I know I don't want to bring it to that, and I'm talking to a psychiatrist right now, so, you know, but I think it could be a really healthy thing for the church and for believers to see it as the first century followers did see it, and that was, you think it's this week? You know, and what would that do? It would cause them to be on fire for Jesus in their life.
Now, I'm going to say a couple of things that I don't have. It's not, there's nothing in the Bible that I know connects to what I'm about to say. This is not like a Bible prophecy. This is not anything that I know. If I say this and you go, oh, no, there's a text. I'd love to see it. Okay. But I'm not aware of one. But I'm just wondering if there is, if just hyperbole, just fantastic, you know, fantasy, or is there an element that might be to this? But have you considered that in 2 years, it's the 2000th anniversary of Christ's baptism in 2027, and in 2031, it's the 2000th anniversary of his crucifixion and resurrection. I don't, again, there's nothing in the Bible that says anything about that. These are significant dates in Christian history. Some people have interpreted, and again, this is not hard Bible, the Bible says it, other than the loose interpretation of with the Lord a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day. And some interpret the millennium as a millennium in which 1,000 years in which the earth is wasted and bare, as it says in Revelation 20, it's laid bare. And it's actually the Greek is the same as the Genesis 1 abyss. Mm-hmm. It's put back into its pre-creation state, okay, for 1,000 years. That is the earth after the six thousand years rests for the Sabbath, 1,000 years rest in its millennium. So some argue this and say this. So we're in a, since life has God created, we're coming to the end of a 6,000 year period, and when Jesus said to his disciples that I'm going to come quickly, that we're in a time dilation field here, that 1,000 years on earth is a day in heaven. And he left 2 days ago when he's coming back from time flow in heaven. It's been 2,000 years on earth. Again, this is not biblical. I just, you know, it's a loose interpretation. But do you think those anniversaries have any meaning?
I think they fall into the cool category for me as well.
Yeah, it's again, remember I said there's no biblical stuff.
Sure.
But could it be used to at least, oh, hey, let's wake up and pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hadn't, I mean, until you said it, I had not thought about that. And so it's kind of flooding me right now, but as it's in that cool factor of, you know, sure, there could be something to that. I mean, I know that we do see throughout scripture, we see God is a God of order, and there does seem to be some very specific type of numberings to things that he has taught us. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, even my mind goes to, you know, he was killed on a Friday and raised on a Sunday, right? I mean, you know, technically, you know, I know we go the 3 day thing, you know, on the third day, but it's a 2 day period.
Well,
that's 2,000 years if we're talking about 1,000 years per day. So I could go into all kinds of
things
with this. Not, but again, I'm with you.
I'm not saying this is a bit, but just when I was drawing our attention again, we believe Christ is coming soon. Is there a reason to be excited about that? I will tell you, my heart has been focused on this for, you know, 35 years. My dad died 35 years ago. And after my dad died, that was the first major close loss that I had. It brought home to me very clearly that if we would do what Peter said, we would do what Jesus said, we could hasten the day. And we could have that experience that Paul wrote about, that our loved ones would be coming up out of the grave renewed, and we could be with our departed family members again. And so there's a passion. It made this world less appealing to me when you lose somebody. This is a grave house, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not, no matter all the beauty you still see of God's creation, this world is marred deeply. It's not how God created it in Eden. Do we agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I have a longing to do whatever I can to help hasten that day. And so, you know, I wanted to have this conversation. The interesting things that I put together, You know, Jesus said in that, and you in prophecy of Matthew, he wove together because the disciples asked him, because the disciples, they saw the temple mount. Mm-hmm. And they were praising the beauty of the temple. And Jesus said, not one stone will be left upon the other. And they conflated because they had in their mind the belief that the second coming will happen when Jerusalem is destroyed. So they asked, what will be the signs of this and the coming of the end of the age? Mm-hmm. So they're asked, what will be the signs of the destruction of Jerusalem? Because that's what they were talking about. And the coming of the end of the age, because they put the two together.
Yes.
Okay. And so Jesus answered their questions by weaving together an answer that gave what you talked about, mm-hmm. the destruction of Jerusalem, AD 70, and the coming of the end of the age. So there's elements there that apply to the end of the age, not to the destruction of Jerusalem. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes. And one of those, I think he said, because I think it makes it clear, it says, this is in Matthew 24:37-39. It says, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Mm-hmm. I think he's making that one. It's not just destruction of Jerusalem there.
Well, go ahead.
Coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them away. That is how it would be at the coming of the Son of Man. And, you know, Peter connects those two as well. One, the world is destroyed once by water, and then once by mm-hmm. the end of time with fire. So making that analogy. So my question, first off, is, notice what Jesus said. They knew nothing about what would happen. The people of Noah's generation mm-hmm. knew nothing. Was Noah not preaching for 120 years? Was he not building an ark? Was it not a spectacle? Did they not see animals 7 days before the flood march into the ark? How is it 120 years of preaching, building this spectacle, they didn't know anything about what was coming? And I'm saying that because I think a great portion of the world, we've had the gospel, we have Christian preachers preaching for generations, and a great portion of the world, when Christ comes, will not know anything. But I think do you think I'm wrong in drawing that conclusion?
Well, I think it connects to what you said earlier about the scoffers. You know, that Noah preached, the people had the information presented to them and they scoffed at it. And, you know,
But Jesus said specifically here, this is what I want to point out. He says they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage.
Right.
And so I'm suggesting that they didn't know because they were caught up with all of the entertainments and fun things of life.
Sure. Yeah. I get what you're saying.
Okay. And do we find the world today more than ever being drawn ever into a spectator entertainment society?
Mm-hmm.
That the word is preached, but they're into their channels, they're into their games, they're into their virtual worlds that are expanding every day. Mm-hmm. And they're cutting themselves out ever, ever more from awareness of the reality of God's kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's still being preached around them, the entertainments and the you know, the programming, is it not designed to capture the world?
And we even see that in the church. I mean, we won the big shifts in the early 2000s. And even if they had the right heart to reach people who weren't familiar with the church culture and try to make it more attractive, that we very much watered down what we're talking about here, this call to be ready. And a lot of sermons even got stylized as basically motivational speeches with a few Bible verses sprinkled in, rather than solid biblical teaching that actually helps us live lives in harmony with God and bringing, like we're saying, that preparation to hasten the day. And even in the church world, it's by and large for many places that entertainment.
So is this a sign? As people get more and more devices, how many people even around there, they're just like this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a sign that we're entering an age where people, they don't actually even, if they go to church, some churches, I'm not trying to criticize,
no.
Become entertainment rather than spiritual developing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll be unaware. Because they're so caught up. I think the technological element has blessed an ability to spread the gospel on certain platforms. But it also, the other side of that, is ever more, even in my own life, I have seen people more and more and more pulled into, you know, spectator entertainment sports, this, that, and the other thing. This is what they live for.
Well, the average, you know, the average American, you know, spends 8 to 10 hours a day on a screen, and the average teenager spends 16. I mean, it's just a lot of our day caught up in that, you know, constantly being entertained, constantly being distracted from what's going on around us in our own virtual world.
And this is, I think, what makes Honey Lake and what we do here, one of the therapeutic elements is that we actually get people in community, mm-hmm. in our RTC, and they're actually talking to each other again, and they're actually listening, and they're actually taking notes, and they're actually processing and thinking again. They're not just spectators absorbing and reacting.
Mm-hmm.
They're in nature. They're getting sunlight.
Yes, right.
All these things.
Yes.
People just don't get on mm-hmm. a regular basis anymore. You know, I mean, I think it is part of the secret sauce, so to speak, here is that, you know, it takes you out of that just inundated world where all you're doing is staring at screens and having all, I mean, it's a peaceful place, you know, and I don't think online is very peaceful. Most
and we know with social media and young people, it creates a fantasy of that ultimately ends up being very fear-inducing and oppressive and insecurity, and drives lots of mental health problems because they have this false perception of actual reality. Because of what the likes or dislikes and feedback that it's just not real,
mm-hmm.
but it creates in their mind this fantasy, and then they become, I don't want to say it in the literal sense, but hypnotized in a mm-hmm. certain way. Their minds don't know how to discern truth from error anymore, reality. I think this is, and they're going to be completely unaware.
Mm-hmm.
What about Jesus said in Matthew 24:12, again, describing the end of time, I think. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold.
Mm-hmm.
When you say the love of most, what does that mean? The love of most will grow cold, and are we seeing that in society?
Kind of like when we were talking about community. I mean, my grandfather used to talk about, you know, we were driving down the road one day, and I just kind of made the comment here in our deep southern town. It feels like there's a church building on every corner. Like, and we even have a church street with 7 churches on the same street. And I kind of mentioned like, wow, there's a lot of them. And he said, well, they're not as close together when you had to walk there. And his point was, I asked him about that, you know, when you had to walk to church, you also had to walk past your neighbor's house. And the church building was the center of that community. And everything was done as a community. You know, you raised barns together, you pulled in the harvest together, you babysat children together, that the community aspect was there. And so you loved each other, not just emotionally. You loved each other with actions. Your heart was to take care of your neighbor like you took care of yourself, the way Jesus did. And now with our isolation, you know, we're kind of stuck in our own homes and our own little worlds, and social media and our phones have kept us from that. And as a result, when we see somebody in need, our love is cold to them. And we don't care as much about the struggles of our neighbor as we used to, because we're not living in that healthy community. Like the early church thought that, hey, everything is up for grabs. If I've got it and you need it, let me take care of you. You know, they didn't consider anything their own. They cared about the love of other people more than the selfishness of isolation of themselves.
Yeah, I like that very much. I actually grew up in a church in the 1960s. It was a small 120-member church. Everything in my childhood revolved around that. I went to a private church school. We had, you know, midweek meetings that we always went to. They had children's programs and activities that when we went and played with other kids, it was always kids from the church,
mm-hmm.
not kids in our actual neighborhood if they weren't from the church. Okay, so while our church wasn't on the same block and as in the old days, we still created that atmosphere. And then they had a department in the church that, you know, it would be called like community services today, but back in that day they called it Dorcas. Out of Dorcas in the Bible, where you would donate clothes and that to help the poor families could come and get clothes for their kids and have to go buy all the infant stuff that only lasts a few months. You have to buy new stuff. And so they had, there's very much what you describe as a church in which I was raised, a small church where everybody cared, everybody, and you knew everybody. So I love that aspect. But the level of many waxing cold as the maybe church communities, it's hard to have when you have a 20,000 member church.
Mm-hmm.
2000, it's hard to have, and you can't know everybody. You feel you get lost. You might, and it becomes more of an entertainment you enjoy, but you don't actually make a lot of connections oftentimes. So that could be hard. But I also look at the the love of many waxing cold in the community, the early church only did what you said, but didn't they have love for their persecutors even in the arenas of Rome? Mm-hmm. It wasn't just love for the community that was they were being supported by and supporting in the fellowship of believers, they had that love, but weren't they loving their enemies?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a certain love waxing cold that, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talked about, if you love only those who love you, love only your brothers, what reward do you have? Don't even the pagans do that? Is there a certain aspect that we love Christians, but we you know, want to have maybe another attitude towards the woke left, maybe? I'm not saying we should. I'm just saying, wonder if that is almost, in other words, we don't have that same love for them.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be an evidence of love is waxing cold?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think it's easier.
Don't let me project that if it's not happening. And in my little narrow part of the world, maybe that might be happening. But in the landscape of Christianity, that's not happening. There's great love for the woke.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Jesus said, and you already mentioned it in the Sermon on the Mount, he mentions in Matthew, when we put Matthew and Luke's accounts together, he said to do three things for your enemies, to pray for them, to bless them, which in their mindset at the time was to speak well of, to find the good qualities, like the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, her children stand and bless her, and then they say good things about her, and many virtuous women that you've surpassed them all, that are we speaking well of those other people? And then the third thing he says to do is to do good things for them, to actually go out of your way to help them. And I don't see that a lot. I see a lot of divisiveness where we're not praying for them, we're not speaking well of them, we're definitely not doing good things for them. And it just creates more division and less love. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of a reinforcing cycle. You know, as we talk about in an individual level with our patients here who have been wronged in an individual mm-hmm. level, that for them to be able to heal, they have to forgive their wrongdoers.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you are the innocent victim of wrong, it wounds you. And that tempts you to be angry, to be resentful, to want to lash out. And if you don't root that hurt out of your own heart, if you become embittered, angry, resentful, then that festers and you actually become infected with the same motives that led to them hurting you. So Jesus gave us that tool to forgive those who have wronged you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it right.
Mm-hmm.
It actually roots out of your heart the evil seed that their wrong tried to plant there.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I think at this time in history, if we don't do that, then it will ultimately make our hearts more callous and hard if we aren't forgiving. And in my view, it's not something I can do as a human. With my own human strength, I can cognitively comprehend the need, but I have to have God's grace in order to be action. And I've had to, many times people have wronged me, but Lord, I know I need to forgive. I don't want to forgive them. I don't want to. I want to embarrass them. I want to expose them. But Lord, I know that's not right. And I've got to wrestle with the Lord, say, Lord, give me a heart. And the Lord, he's always done it. My heart changes. And then I don't rally.
Mm-hmm.
But have you ever had that wrestling too? And then I have more peace.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess, you know, the big question I would say that comes to my mind when talking about the topic we're discussing is that cold, is that, I guess, hardening, you know, is that worse than other times in history? You know, because I think of something like it's been said a couple of times here, Middle Ages or Dark Ages, you know, just after the fall of Rome. And then also you have, you know, the Crusades are a great example. Wouldn't that have been like the ultimate cold? Like there was no praying for those enemies. It was, we're actually going to kill them, you know, and we're on the side of justice is what they believe. I don't think they were doing it out of pure evil intentions, but are we worse off today than we were then?
Yes, yes, and here's why. Here's my understanding why. As I look at the unfolding of the gospel commission going to the world, Satan immediately begins trying to crush it. Immediately, yeah. Initially through overt physical persecution of the Roman state. And that instead did not work.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually spread through the means we've already described of the gracious, loving, fearlessness that the martyrs had in the arenas, because the Romans were terrified of death. And they see this group of people who just have peace as they're being martyred in the arenas. And they would sneak out and go, why aren't they terrified? And they learned about Jesus and the gospel spread. And so after that first generation, the devil's attack switched from overt persecution to corruption, to infecting Christianity with a false interpretation of what Christ has accomplished for us and making the church function like the state, an imperial, authoritarian, dictatorial, abusive system in the name of Jesus that will use the cross to go and persecute your enemies. And that's what the church became. It was a different form of attack. And my view of reading the scriptures that you can find this prophetically described, the man of sin, Paul talks about, the second coming will not happen until the man of sin, that man of perdition, the man of lawlessness arises, sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. This is not the temple in Jerusalem, because it's destroyed a few years after he writes this. And certainly the man of sin doesn't rise up into heaven and knock Jesus off his throne. So about the spirit temple, that Christianity is going to be infected with a distorted view where the spirit temple is worshiping a corrupt version of God. And this is what I see here described. And so why is this different? And so, yes, you see this happening, but throughout human history, up until now in history, there was always a place where the faithful could flee the persecution. And the United States ultimately became the place where the faithful, wanting to worship God according to the dictates of their conscience, fled this persecution and established this land of liberty and religious freedom. When things turn out that, and if, and I can say if or when, if or when, the United States ever betrays its constitutional protections and does, like the Dark Ages church, that Christian nationalism, there's nowhere else in the world to run. There's no place you can go and establish another land of liberty. So we're finding ourselves again in a place where there's no new lands to be claimed by the pure church to establish the freedoms of conscience anymore. And that's why I think it will be different this time.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah, sir.
Yeah. And so yes, you can see those same exact, because the devil's the devil, and you'll see those same tactics used in various places and times. But the world, it'll be my understanding that before Christ, it'll be worldwide, not continent restricted.
Well, yeah, I mean, just, yeah, and the way in my mind heard that even was just, well, the church has advanced and society has advanced, the world has advanced, there's no more land, so to speak. The advancement of things has taken place at such a rapid rate, even in the last couple hundred years, that, yeah, I can ride with that. I like that.
So I actually see, you mentioned the weaving together, and you said, and you mentioned of the prophecies there, mm-hmm. of destruction, and how the Jesus gave a sign of the abomination and cause of destruction, mm-hmm. the armies circling Jerusalem, and they did, mm-hmm. and then they pulled back for a short period, and all the Christians left.
Mm-hmm.
They were not destroyed because they saw the sign.
They listened to Jesus.
Yep. Okay. I see that because it is a dual fulfillment prophecy, mm-hmm. and you've already woven that together for us. And this is now my interpretation again, so it's okay to disagree with me. Okay. But I believe that was historical. It happened, but it also serves as an object lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And the circling of the metaphorical circling of the armies, I think we've already experienced. It happened. And we're now in that brief time before the actual destruction. When did it happen? I believe it happened during COVID. And what happened during COVID is you saw practically overnight the worldwide governments circling to take away liberty of conscience and coerce people to do things, restrict their travel, restrict their worship. Churches were closed, force them to, or pressure them to put things in their body that some didn't want to do. Worldwide, global control, conscience, coercion. And then we pulled back. And this is my interpretation. But I see that as metaphorical application of the literal what happened. And now we're in that brief period. And the faithful do not flee geographically. They recognize those methods are not godly. And they flee from those methods in their heart, mind. And they won't participate when the next world system comes along to coerce, which I think will be that rising of that system of revelation, which will be worldwide conscience coercion. They won't participate with it because they've recognized this and they've come out and say, no, I'm a liberty of conscience person. I'm a truth, love, and freedom person. I'm not a coerce others person. So that's another reason why I think we're really, really close now. Because, I mean, would you have thought if we could go back to 2019 and I went to any American church, any church, said, how many of you
would support the government in shutting your church down for 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 months, how many hands would have gone up?
How many did?
Not all. There were some that resisted, but the vast majority supported it. As constitutional, it was not constitutional.
Right.
There was no constitutional. There's nothing in the Constitution that says your constitutional right to worship and assembly can be restricted because of a virus or an infection or a sickness.
Do you think most did it out of fear?
Yes, that's my point. The fear.
More so than like the, you know, the governmental side of it, or I guess the constitutional side of it, but definitely the, are we protecting our people by doing this? I think that was the pastors I talked to, that was their big struggle is, am I going to kill off my old population by having the church open?
There's a difference between saying our church is open and we leave every person free to decide whether you want a fellowship you want there.
That was the third rail that everyone probably should have taken.
That is the rail that I was advocating from the beginning, all the way back from the very beginning. If you have you present the truth and love and leave people free. The problem that we saw was governmental enforcement of restrictions of liberties.
Well, in our own understanding of, look at, say, church attendance. I mean, you know, who's been away from church and you get the, hey, I haven't seen you for a while. You know, it's that little bit of a...
No, not the same. No. I want you to hear this point. Understand the goal of what the governments did.
Yeah.
Was to save lives. It was a righteous goal.
Yeah.
It was a righteous goal. The methods that they used were not righteous.
Oh, sure. And what I was referring to is, I think if people took that third rail with the church to say, hey, we're going to be open, it is up to you if you come.
Yeah.
As long as we did that and then didn't shame people.
No,
for me, that fear, hey, you don't have faith. You know, you show up, Jesus is going to protect you.
And I gotcha.
We had that. I mean, I knew some people who actually died in their churches, you know, well, after going to church and they got it there. And, you know, again, that was not a, I don't think any of them were guilted into going. And, you know, those are just a couple of specific examples, but I think there would be a lot of that, you know, oh man, I don't want to be the one guy not showing up because then it shows I don't have the same faith as the guy next to me, you know, and that's sad. I think there was a lot of that happening too, which is unfortunate. It shouldn't have been that way.
Again, you know, sign of the time.
Yeah.
Would you have thought that in 2019 that you could get essentially every government of the world to shut down liberties this quickly?
Yeah.
How quick did it happen? So I think that's a sign for me personally. I see it metaphorically. Mm-hmm. And now you notice we have this sense of liberty and freedom. We can travel again. Don't have to wear masks. You're not restricted. You don't have to show some little card that says you got to experimental jab. That was an experiment. No safety data. No actual evidence of efficacy. None.
Yeah.
I mean, you think through, look back and you think through, this should be a wake-up call spiritually for people. How is it the minds of so many people could have been so seduced into participating in something that had no efficacy and lots of harm and the restrictions of your freedoms? Again, I don't criticize offering it as a, we don't know. It could help. It might not. We don't have the data yet. We're frightened. We want to do the best we can. Take it if you don't. Don't if you don't. I would have no criticism for that. But that's not what happened. What happened was purposeful misinformation, deception through coercive enforcement through governments. And some Christians stood up but pastors, you know, the report, certain pastors were arrested in certain nations of this world because they wouldn't close their churches.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to do my job, travel internationally for missions without that card.
Yeah.
The school, visiting a school I was going to said, you can't be part of this program because you got to come on campus if you don't have this card. Yeah.
And my view is that, you know, if I would have been in charge, magically in charge of all the Christian Methodist, Baptist, Adventist, Catholic healthcare systems, and there's lots of these, I would have immediately instructed them all to refuse and to have their lawyers file injunctions in America where you can do this, because everything that was done was without evidence, violated all norms of medical ethics as well as Christian ethics. You understand, never in the history of modern medical ethics is it ethical to coerce people to participate in a medical experiment, which is technically what this was?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the problem was, if you said anything, you were killing grandma.
Right. And this is also part of the misinformation, which is untrue.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but even still today, what are we, 5 years out?
Mm-hmm.
It's still hard for people to think it through. They get very defensive on this.
Mm-hmm.
Understand from a spiritual warfare perspective, what was done to the hearts and minds of people to get good people to collude with practices. I think this to me is a big sign that we're really in the last days. And I don't say this to people to frighten people. And so maybe in the last couple of minutes we have, if we are in fact in the last days, Christ is coming soon. We don't know. We don't have a date or an hour. Is there anything as Christians we personally should do different in our lives than we're doing, or just occupy till, you know, Jesus, occupy till I come? Occupy. If you're living a godly life and filling his calling, and just keep doing it, or is there anything special that we would?
Well, I think a lot of what we're doing here is important. You know, if we believe we can hasten the day, if we believe we're Christ's ambassadors, that God is making his appeal through us to bring the gospel, then we need to be good at doing that. And one of the things that has happened throughout American church history in the last 100 years is we became, after all the evil we saw, you know, Great Depression, all that, the church made a very conscious shift from solid teaching and apologetics to just get everybody converted, go to heaven. Like even the songs I grew up singing, some glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away. Yeah, when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. So heaven focused that we forgot to get involved with bringing the kingdom here. And
isn't there a saying that says, don't be so heaven focused for no earthly good?
That's right. Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And so rather than saying, oh, well, God, you know the time and I'm just going to kick back. I'm part of your people. I'm saved. I'm good. If God is really making his appeal through us, we need to be good at being those ambassadors. You know, Peter says, always be prepared to give an answer to people when they ask you about your faith. And we know this, but I love this connection. The Greek word there, apologia, is an apology. It goes to apologetics. Are we good at apologetics? Can we defend our faith and can we explain it well to the people that are asking these good questions so they will consider how God's kingdom actually works, what God's character actually is, and actually, you know, get in alignment with him and choose to receive that gift of salvation he wants to give them.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant because I think that's ultimately, you know, how things are unfolding. Events are happening on planet Earth that those with sensitive hearts are looking. What's going on? What's happening? Mm-hmm. And God needs his witnesses to be able to say, let me explain to you what's happening. Let me explain to you from a creationist understanding revealed to us through his word, where we stand in the landscape of time and why these things are happening, mm-hmm. rather than, I have no idea what's happening. The metaphor that is used both by Christ and Paul is that when you see these various things happening we've been talking about, they're like labor pains in mm-hmm. a woman going into. And when labor pains come upon a woman, they do not come with the greatest intensity and rapidity, closeness together. At first, they actually get more intense and closer together all the way up until delivery. And these events are going to get more intense and closer together until delivery. Christ mm-hmm. delivers us. But if a woman knows she's pregnant and she's, you know, 8.5 months, nine months, and the labor pains start, she typically does not go, please, Lord, can we put this off another 9 months? Even though she knows it's going to be painful, she's not actually looking for a delay. Is she?
No.
Let's see this over. No. How many Christians, they see somebody who thinks, Lord, please, let's not, okay, rather than let's hasten the day. Mm-hmm. First point. Second point on the labor metaphor is, what would it be like for a woman, and there's been cases, reports, where they end up in the emergency with terrible, terrible abdominal cramps, and they're pregnant, and they didn't know. These are typically obese women,
mm-hmm.
but they're pregnant, 9 months, they're delivering. They had no clue they were pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
What will it be like when the labor pains, for those who have no idea where we are, what's happening, why it's happening? It'd be terrifying. For those who actually understand, Jesus said, lift up your head and rejoice. Redemption draws near. That's the woman who goes into labor. Yes, it's going to be, but I'm rejoicing because my baby is about to come. Okay? And so I think our mindset on this, and this is where these witnesses you're talking about need to be there so we can help people understand, hey, rejoice, we're about to be delivered. I hope this was a helpful program for you. Thanks for joining us today. I personally believe Jesus is coming soon. This is why we have this program, and all of us have committed our lives to advancing the gospel, because we want to hasten the day. Wherever you are, we invite you to be part of our team. Share this podcast with others. Go to the Come and Reason website, get free resources, and share in your community. And prepare your heart and mind, as Pastor James was saying, to be able to give that answer, that reason for the faith that is in you. So when your neighbor asks, what's going on? What's going on? You can give them an answer. Lift up their head. Redemption is drawing nigh. If you have questions, send those into questions@designformore.net. Questions@designformore.net. And we'll see you again next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.